It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us on the Ideas Network. Coming up, Apple hit the $1 trillion mark in its stock market valuation. We'll look at the rise of mega companies and their effect on the economy. First, some conservatives are criticizing the move by several social media platforms to remove content posted by inflammatory conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. He's claimed that the 9/11 attacks and the Oklahoma City bombing were inside jobs, that survivors of the high school shooting in Parkland, Florida were crisis actors, that the Sandy Hook school shooting in 2012 was a hoax, and he backed the more recent Pizzagate hoax. Jones's critics say his unproven accusation get his supporters worked up and cause them to make threats and harass and intimidate people targeted in his theories. On Sunday, Apple took down five of Jones's podcasts. By the end of Monday, Facebook, YouTube, Spotify, and LinkedIn, along with Pinterest, had removed some or all of Jones's content as well. Jones warned on his radio show yesterday that this was just the beginning.
Mainstream corporate media is fake news. They're the enemy of the American people, like the president said. And now they're coming after everybody.
Brent Bozell, founder of the Conservative Media Research Center, and Senator Ted Cruz have criticized technology companies for removing Jones's content. Mike Snyder is the tech and money reporter for USA Today. Mike, welcome to Central Time.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
Well, the shoes have been dropping one after another, it seems like. Can you talk about the different platforms that have banned or dropped or limited material coming from Alex Jones and his InfoWar website?
Well, I was asleep when a lot of this happened, thankfully, but sometime Sunday, Apple removed episodes of Jones' show and another four other InfoWars-related podcasts from its iTunes and podcast apps. And prior to that, you know, he had been on the radar of social media companies and online streaming companies like Spotify, because last week Spotify, they didn't really say how it happened, but people started realizing that Spotify had started listing more than a year's worth of Alex Jones, the Alex Jones Show, the podcast version. And for several days, people on Twitter were complaining that subscribers, at least they said they were subscribers, were complaining about Spotify hosting this material. Spotify told me that an aggregator basically automatically put it up at some point. Anyway, last week Spotify took down four episodes, and of course that the clamor increased. It's like, why did you take down four? What about the rest? So after Apple did its move, somewhere along the line, Spotify took down all of the podcasts. Also, Facebook, which has been saying it's going to increase its efforts to reduce false, misleading information news posts, had been criticized for not taking down Alex Jones and InfoWars pages. And, you know, this then finally decided to take down, you know, all the pages they had. And then also you had, YouTube, which had issued a strike against Jones previously for some videos that were up on that site, removed him and InfoWars channels too. So all of a sudden, within about less than 12 hours, it went boom, like dominoes, boom, 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 all these things happened.
What were the grounds that the social media companies gave? It sounds like they weren't focused on the fake news side of things as much.
Correct. That's right. I mean, each of them used some form of description of hate speech being in the content, and then also one of the sites I'm looking here because it does get kind of confusing. Facebook also mentioned that some of the content broke its policy against bullying. So I didn't listen to all these or watch these, so I can't tell you what hate speech was invoked that Facebook felt met that qualification, but that's what they're saying.
Can you talk about kind of the bind these various platforms have been in? They, on the one hand, have said they don't, in the past, they don't want to be policing what the content is, policing political viewpoints, but they're under a lot of pressure with this case in particular, given Sandy Hook conspiracy theories and pretty inflammatory speech coming from Alex Jones and InfoWars.
Well, Jones is on the radar for multiple reasons. I mean, I think it was earlier this year, Megyn Kelly did an interview with him as one of her first live, or not live, but one of her first profile interviews she did when she took her show over. May have been last fall, I forget. So people started getting to know more mainstream people got to know who Alex Jones was. Now you're also seeing some court cases, action is happening where you're getting coverage of court cases where Sandy Hook families and a police officer who was involved in that event at the elementary school, the shooting at the elementary school, has sued Jones and InfoWars and the parent company, I forget the exact name, basically for saying, you know, he was passing along a conspiracy theory that that the Sandy Hook event actually didn't happen, and these were child actors and child, you know, everybody was acting this out to try to, you know, I guess in some effect to manipulate the political discussion about gun control. Meanwhile, you have Facebook, Twitter, and YouTube, which were manipulated to some extent during the 2016 presidential campaign with, you know, fake Russian accounts that were like on Facebook, you know, actually creating events that fake events that people would go to, and they were actually, you know, putting out information on both sides of an issue. So you might have people coming in favor of an event, you know, of an issue at this event, but then you would have the alternate side, which was against whatever this issue or candidate might be coming to this event. So you had what they were doing was, you know, basically fomenting public discord, you know, in the United States. So all these outlets are under, you know, extreme scrutiny right now. They also don't, you know, we have such a politicized environment. They don't want to be seen as favoring liberal or right. So they've treaded very carefully. Now, I guess at some point, I don't know if all the lawyers got together over the weekend and said, you know, well, here's our stance and what we could do, and boom, 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 this stuff happened. But they're making a stand, at least, on what Jones was selling.
Talking to Mike Snyder, tech and money reporter for USA Today, about a bunch of online platforms dropping most or all content from Alex Jones and his InfoWars website. Twitter, one website, one social media source that has not done this. And there are a lot of debates among Twitter users about the presence of Nazis and right-wing bullying on the website. That is one platform that doesn't seem to have made a change here.
At this point, no. I mean, I think I've been talking to some experts for a follow-up story about, you know, about the First Amendment and free speech and all that, and they're telling me that, you know, Twitter is trying to take things a slightly differently because it is almost a public commons of commenting on things where you can kind of get away from it if you want to, and they have a different kind of standard where if you start threatening someone or personally, that's where Twitter gets riled up and comes, you know, maybe has to take some action. But if you're just talking about hateful speech in general, you know, they have kind of let it go. That's the way I understand it at this point.
Looking at a lot of these sites, it seems like there's a tension between, okay, just about anything goes short of threatening behavior in that case. But on the other hand, is our brand tainted by us hosting particular viewpoints that are particularly odious? And is that maybe going to start to change toward that latter point? Our brands are in danger if we're associated with things like Alex Jones?
Well, I think that's probably one aspect that led to the events of this week. While Alex Jones may have a rabid following that brought people to Facebook and YouTube and possibly Spotify. I mean, you know, Spotify, he has millions of listeners without Spotify, but, you know, I'm sure a lot of people pass things along. That's the value of Facebook. It's easy to pass things along to your friends versus, you know, going to the InfoWars site. But, you know, while he has an audience, I think it looks like Facebook decided the value of that audience is not worth the value of disrupting and upsetting the rest of its audience. whether we'll have a discussion, you know, whether Congress or someone, you know, some body will, you know, bring up this idea of, you know, when, you know, have these companies acted properly at this point, or do they need to be new rules for engagement because they have such a foothold in our public discourse? I could foresee that coming down the road. But right now it seems like, you know, I think they're following the legal rules they need to, but they may rethink how to do it, you know, more transparently in the future.
I know you've been watching some of the reaction on this story. What are you watching for next? Because this is all still pretty fresh news.
Well, you know, it's one of those things where what you think might be next, you know, will surprise you, and it won't be anything about what you think next. I was asking, of course, the first thing I thought was someone would there be a lawsuit? But the experts that I've talked to so far think that these companies are well within the rights the way they did things. Now, will there be some kind of is there any way to do a public, you know, exit, you know, people that really wanted, you know, their followers of Jones, you know, if they did some kind of a public exodus from Facebook or something, would that gather attention? These are, if you have people who are followers of a, whatever side, whether you want to say ultra-liberal, ultra-conservative, far-right, far-left, you know, these people are very engaged, and I can't foresee either side very often just letting things drop. You know, you almost think they're planning something to respond, because that's kind of why that's why there is an ultra and a far spectrum of this, of our political discourse at this point.
We'll leave it there for now. Mike, thanks for joining us today.
Well, thanks for having me.
Mike Snyder is the tech and money reporter for USA Today. We talked with him about the decision by Apple, Facebook, Spotify, and YouTube to remove content by conspiracy theorist Alex Jones. Right now, the technology giant Apple hit a milestone last week when it became the first publicly traded company to be valued at $1 trillion. That's trillion with a TR. And some economists say that with economic muscle like that, mega companies like Apple are helping the economy, but others say their market dominance is contributing to low wages and social inequality. Matt Phillips is a markets reporter for the New York Times. His recent piece is titled Apple's $1 trillion milestone reflects the rise of powerful mega companies. Matt, welcome to Central Time.
Hey, thanks. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk about what that trillion-dollar number means. What does it mean when to say it has Apple has a market valuation over $1 trillion?
So it's really just a basic formula. It's the market price for the company, which today I think is around $209, times the shares outstanding. And that basically is, in the aggregate, the value that all the investors that are out there in their wisdom, you know, put on the company as a whole. So it went over $1 trillion, which is just something we've never really seen before, at least in our lifetimes.
And some of your colleagues at the Times did this visualization there showing, you know, how many other, you know, common name companies you'd have to add together to get one Apple. And it's pretty incredible. Apple is huge, even in the scope of huge companies now, right?
It is really remarkable, and they're huge for a reason. I mean, they generate really massive profits because they produce innovative products that consumers really find irresistible, and they charge pretty high prices for them, as you might have noticed. So that, for investors, is a dream. So that is really one of the reasons why the price has gone so high, pushing the value of the company up.
Now, earlier I used the phrase mega companies like Apple. Is there anybody like Apple, or is there anybody else who's in that ballpark and nearing that $1 trillion mark?
Well, you know, a few years ago, we probably would have said no, but you can see now that some of the other big companies that have a tech platform where they're dominant in some way are also up there. So Amazon.com is flirting with about $900 billion, which, you know, is only $100 billion away from a trillion. That's real money. And then there's also Microsoft itself has been doing exceptionally well. That's also around 850 or above that. And Google's parent Alphabet is also worth more than 800 $800 billion. And these are all just really, really incredibly dominant companies in their field.
We've seen in the past concentration of industries. You know, there were, you know, dozens and dozens of car companies, what, just a century ago or so. They whittled down to just a few American companies. Are we seeing industry, especially things like the technology industry, more concentrated than industries of the past?
Well, you know, it's really hard. It's really hard to tell exactly. I mean, we know that the economy in general, especially the corporate economy, is becoming more concentrated, with a larger chunk of the profits accruing to just a smaller and smaller number of companies. But when you break it down in industries, it becomes really difficult for economists to say, because, you know, what industry is Apple in? Are they a music company? They have Apple Music. You know, they have they're a marketplace themselves where they sell their apps. They don't really correspond. I mean, are they a computer company? You know, they don't quite correspond to any pure industry. And that's sort of why this presents something of a challenge when we talk about the concentration levels on an individual industry level. Like, would you say Amazon is just a online retailer? Would you say they're just sort of a retailer writ large, and sort of in that way they're competing with Walmart? I mean, the answer is probably both, but it gets very difficult to kind of siphon these off and make a very crisp declaration that this industry is more or less concentrated. But, you know, you just have to sort of sit back and kind of think, as you just did, you know, think a little bit about what you've seen in your lifetime. You know, the number of banks with the larger chunk of the country's financial assets has shrunk. You know, just think of the airline industry. You know, we've seen a lot of consolidation there. So, you know, I think it's fair to say that the economy as a whole has become a lot more concentrated among the corporate giants.
Talking to markets reporter Matt Phillips from the New York Times, Apple is a 13-digit number now. Apple hit the trillion-dollar level in its valuation, talking about the impact of that and other huge companies. Matt, in your writing on this, you looked at arguments that say, hey, this is good for the economy that we have these huge companies, and that it's bad. First, look at the upside. What are people saying about the possible upside of this kind of concentration, these huge companies?
Well, you know, this is kind of the optimistic way people will think about it, you know, is that these companies are so big because they generate such massive benefits for consumers. I mean, if you think about, you know, this is a little bit different than some of the large companies that have exerted a lot of market power in the past. These companies, a lot of them give away their product for free to consumers, at least. So Google, you know, that's just a remarkable service that people wouldn't have been able to conceive of, that you could just find the answer to any question, you know, by typing it in, you know, in you know, even well into the 90s, you know, that would have been hard to imagine. So more Apple, with, you know, its products are just incredibly sought after around the world. So there's huge consumer benefits that these companies generate, which can be difficult to quantify economically, just because so much of it is actually free. You know, Facebook is free to consumers. So that's one of the upside, and the optimistic way of looking at that is that these companies have gotten so big because they are so innovative, because they are so productive, and that's true. That's true in a lot of instances. The downside is sometimes, you know, it's a company doesn't have to be either or. You know, you can start off really innovative, establish a really strong market position, and then use your market power to protect your entrenched position. So that's the thing that some economists are saying that we need to keep an eye on, just because these companies are so big.
And worries about contributions of these concentrated companies to income inequality, you write.
Yeah, you know, that's kind of one of the interesting things. It's a little bit hard to figure when you think about companies like Apple and Google. I mean, these are, you know, they pay a lot of really good salaries to a lot of people. You know, if you think about Google, you know, those are sort of really hotly sought after jobs for recent graduates and engineers and computer programmers. But, you know, as these companies kind of take a larger chunk of the economy, the argument is because they are so big and the amount they pay their workers just as a share of the amount of profits is so small, that it sort of in the aggregate lowers how much workers get as a share of the economy. And there's a kind of a concrete way you can think about this. You know, think about Excel, you know, Microsoft's Excel, a great program. I use it every day. A lot of people do. You know, it's delivered a lot of consumer benefits to people, and it's taken, it's done a lot of business. They've sold a lot of copies of it. But, you know, it's not, it has not been great for bookkeepers, you know. So there's a lot of those sort of middle skill jobs that have kind of gone away over the last 20 years as these technological behemoths have sprouted up. And a lot of economists are starting to look at that connection now.
And another up or downside thing as we start to wrap up, if these huge companies do well, it makes an economy look good. It makes a stock market look pretty good. What happens if one or two of these companies starts to start striking out? And how much does that hurt the economy?
Well, it's hard to say. You know, the economy, it might be not as big a deal as it could be for the stock market. You know, they're related, but not exactly the same thing. So the stock market has become pretty reliant on some of these big companies, which have sort of carried the broader indexes higher just because the indexes are weighted by the size of the company. So if you're a bigger company like an Apple or an Amazon, you have more influence on how the stock market indexes move. So over the last few years, that's been a huge benefit to investors who are sort of broadly invested in sort of like passive index funds or things like that, because it's helped pull the overall markets higher. The concern some people have is that if they start to falter a little bit, or if even more than a little bit, then that could pull the overall indexes lower and act as an anchor. So that would be the risk. On the other hand, you know, a lot of people are still very bullish on these companies, given they do have such an entrenched position in these fast-growing industries.
Matt, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
That's Matt Phillips, markets reporter for the New York Times, talking to us about the growing concentration of American corporations as Apple hits the $1 trillion mark in its stock market valuation. First, as the baby boomer generation gets older, America will be seeing more people in their 60s, 70s, and 80s, and if current trends continue, more of them will be staying in the workforce. According to national numbers, a higher percentage of older people are working or looking for work than at any point on record, doing all kinds of jobs, from crossing guard to professional management. The move towards more older workers is also raising awareness of age discrimination from potential employers. Jim Flaherty is the communications director for AARP Wisconsin, and he's with us in the studio. Jim, welcome to Central Time.
Well, thanks so much for having me on. This is such an important topic.
Well, I was looking at charts for national trends, and definitely it's clear people in their 80s, 70s, they're more likely to be at work. Is this something you're seeing here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. The numbers in Wisconsin are fairly parallel to the national. Nationally, we've got about 64% of individuals age 55 to 64 in the workplace. Those are very, very similar to Wisconsin. Among those 65 and older, 19.3% of Wisconsinites and 19.1% of all U.S. residents are in the workforce. So just about exactly the same, a little bit higher in Wisconsin of folks returning and staying in the workplace much longer.
I assume the story might be different from person to person. Mm-hmm. That said, what are some of the general reasons that we're seeing people work later in life?
You know, it is all over the map. And, you know, there's this perception of old people, they're just going to shut down and go away or remain in their homes and be frail and elderly and sick. And that is not the case at all. You know, elderly folks they're out there. We're living a lot longer now through advances in healthcare and technology and modern medicine. Folks are going back because they have certain skill sets that they've spent an entire lifetime accumulating, and they want to share those. We have volunteers all over for AARP Wisconsin. They have got incredible experiences to be able to share. And our studies show and our experiences show that they want to give back to the community. You know, they've lived in their hometowns their whole lives, moved around, and they want to give back. So they have a career, but then after that career is over, they want to work in their schools, their churches, their community centers, or, you know, food pantries, things like that, to be able to give back, whether it's pay or not pay. They want to be as active as they can as they age.
I assume in some cases, though, it's people who need the money. We're living longer on average, which is good news, but that means those retirement savings, even if you have them, which isn't always the case, it's not going to be enough for that 10 years we might be living longer.
That's exactly right. People are going back specifically to supplement their income. You know, Medicare and Social Security are basic programs that are there to help us get to the next level, but they are not meant to be the be-all, end-all of what you should do in retirement. So lots of folks are supplementing their income either to buy a Medicare supplement or, you know, in, with Social Security, folks are just working longer so that they can get the full payout at age 70 rather than retiring at 62, 63, 65. They want to get the whole shebang, so they're working longer to get that higher payout.
Talking to Jim Flaherty from AARP Wisconsin, talking about people working until later and later ages over the years, 60s, 70s, 80s, some of the challenges and opportunities. And let's look at one of those challenges, Jim. We hear in some fields in particular concerns about age discrimination for people over 60, for some cases in technology fields, for people over 40, I think.
Ageism is very, very prevalent in our society. Folks who leave a job in their 50s and later on have twice as hard of a job trying to get back into the workplace. There's all kinds of myths about older workers that simply aren't true. You know, that they are frail, that they're sickly, they're going to be out more because they have a, you know, a series of ailments. The numbers just don't back that up. You know, almost the opposite is true. You know, you've got workers who are very committed and engaged, and you know, they're loyal. They put a lot of work and effort into their careers, and they are not going to walk away from that job because they've got, you know, the sniffles or they've got some ailment that folks think they might just have to walk away because they just don't feel well. There's no statistics that back that up. Folks are older workers are more valuable to the workplace, in my opinion, than some of the younger folks who are just entering the workplace. And experience and dedication and loyalty are the main factors.
One notion that I think is out there, and I've talked to a guest who says, no, this is a myth, but a notion that's out there is as people get older, they're not in touch with the latest technology. They're not able to adapt to a changing technological environment.
That is absolutely another myth. Older workers can be trained. They want to be trained. We have folks calling to us all the time that are taking advantage of some of the AARP programs to hook them up to their iPhones, their iPads. Technology is something that younger people think older people are afraid of, but in fact, the numbers aren't backing that up either. They are willing to be retrained, and they want to re-engage in society, and technology is a major part of that.
Yeah, what kind of resources are out there for older workers, especially maybe those who are out of a job for one reason or another, looking to get back into the job market?
We have such a fabulous resource at AARP. Just go to AARP.org, and you can type in just about anything you want. Tips on how to re-enter the marketplace, skill strengthening courses. We have an unbelievable amount of resources that are just a click of a button away. I would encourage all of your listeners, just go to www.arp.org and there'll be a search bar. Whatever you're looking for, those resources are there.
Now, the report that kind of started us off talking about this was in the New York Times, and they tracked a bunch of different types of jobs and looked at where seniors were overrepresented, were high numbers. Do you have a sense of where older workers are here in Wisconsin?
Well, you know, it is a fact that as you get older, your body is going to start to wear down. That's just the simple math of getting older. So, you know, some of the more difficult jobs, they're going to lean away from those. If it's more physically demanding, you know, remember our parents, 30s and 40s, they were working in, hauling steel beams and things like that. Those kind of jobs have shipped out. Some of those blue collar jobs that are more physically demanding, the jobs that are happening now and that are available now, you know, consulting, contracting, sharing some of their skill sets with younger folks to a degree, computers, technology. These are jobs, healthcare, where they can provide their expertise without it taking a physical toll on their body. And these are some of the workplace jobs that we are seeing people re-enter because they want to use the skill set that they've accumulated over their entire lifetime. And I think employers would be wise to recognize that.
Now, there's almost a whole profession based on helping people of different generations communicate at the workplace. And sometimes I think they oversell the differences between the generations. But that said, are there ways that workplaces can help bridge gaps between millennials and Gen Xers, say, and the new generation coming in, and the baby boomers who are aging and still in the workplace?
You know, this is all about breaking down the walls that of myths that exist. You know, the first thing you should be doing is talking to folks. You know, I work in an office where, we have six different offices, and each person is texting if you need something, or emailing, or instant messaging. Go over and talk to them. You know, find out if somebody is 40 years older than you and you work with them, go over and sit down and have a nice conversation with them, you would be shocked to learn how much older workers bring to the table as far as life experiences, just anything and everything, knowledge base. And I think the younger workers have built up a perception that, okay, I'm only going to talk to my fellow younger workers because they get it. They get technology. They get what I'm working on. And, you know, I would encourage them and the older workers the same way. Go the other way. Talk to the younger folks. Pick their brains. You know, find out what do they know that you don't know that you could learn from them. These barriers have got to be broken down.
Talking to Jim Flaherty, Communications Director for AARP Wisconsin. He's talking with us about the experience of older people in the workforce. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Is this you? Or if you're in your 60s, 70s, or above, are you still working part-time, full-time? What's keeping you working? Is it financial necessity, desire to be out there in the world to share your skills? As Jim was saying, have you faced obstacles in the workplace because of your age? And whatever age you are, do you think your retirement years, quote unquote, retirement years are going to include a job? What do you think about maybe the older people in your workplace? How do you all get along from different generations? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Jim Flaherty, Communications Director for AARP Wisconsin, talking about older adults in the workforce. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you're 60s, 70s, 80s, are you working? Are you working past retirement age? Did you retire and then come back into the workforce? We'd love to hear your story. At any age, are you hoping to, planning to work well into your old age for one reason or another? If you're an employer, do you hire people in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and wherever you are in the workplace, do you see discrimination against people who are older and trying to get a job? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll go to our callers. Mark is with us in Wisconsin Dells. Mark, hi.
Hi, how you doing? I just wanted to call in while I'm up on top of it. Well, I have a signal to say that I've been working since 1 a.m. this morning, and I'll work working about five more hours. I work 7 days a week. I'm 68 years old. I retired from the university, and I went back to school to get a teaching certificate in Wisconsin, and I was told, at Stevens Point, you will not get hired. And they're right. I can't even get an interview as a teacher, but I do substitute teach. It's okay for grandpa to babysit. Now, what I've learned in working a lot of different jobs before I basically became a contractor and do a lot of work now, is that people don't want to hire somebody who is more competent than they are. They're worried about their job. And the other thing is, nobody will hire their grandpa. People will not hire older people than they are. That's really hard for them to do. And I sort of understand that psychologically. But that's something that, you know, in all of these discussions I've heard on the radio about hiring old people and old people finding jobs, is one of the real problems that I perceive, is that people just won't hire somebody older than they are. They don't really want to supervise somebody that's senior to them in age.
Interesting, Mark. Well, he gave us a lot to work with there. Let's start with that idea that maybe it's not intentional. An employer is saying, I will not hire an old person for these reasons. But psychologically, there's this perception. I don't want to manage somebody who's older than me.
That's exactly right. Mark, thank you for the call. That is an example of ageism. That's saying that I don't want to hire this person simply because I believe their age is a hindrance to them doing a successful job, whether or not be better than you or equal to you, doesn't matter. They're making a decision not to hire someone based on their age. And that is just absolutely wrong. So, you know, the other reasons people don't hire folks that are older, they're like, okay, well, we might not have them along. They might not stay that long. You know, they're closer to retirement. We might train them for a half a year and then only get them for a year or two. So there are logistical reasons that employers think through. But as far as utilizing experience and knowledge base and those kind of things, it makes absolutely no sense not to hire somebody older because they bring so much to the table.
I want to throw a word at you. Thanks for that call, Mark. Overqualified. Is that something that seniors might run into? Like, well, this guy's great. So this woman's great. but it's an entry-level position. They're overqualified.
Yeah, overqualified is a word that can be used for all ages, not just older folks. You know, so a lot of firms will not hire somebody if they come in expecting a certain pay grade for the work that they're being asked to do, and they simply are overqualified for it. So that the overqualification is not ageism. Hiring someone simply because they're older is ageism. So that hits all age groups.
Thanks again for the call, Mark. We'll go now to Dave in Fort Atkinson. Dave, hi.
Hi. Well, I'm a 62-year-old truck driver. I've been a truck driver for over 40-some years. What I see is an awful lot of people coming into this industry that had never thought in their wildest dreams that they would have been a truck driver, because they get let go of a job when they're in their later 50s. But, you know, trucking has changed in the last 8 years with electronic logging and emailing and everything, tablets. I was really afraid of this new technology coming on. But I got to tell you, some of these younger people I work around, in our office, the average age of the person in the office is 28, and the average age of the truck drivers that I work with are 48. So there's a pretty good span there. But I got to tell you, these younger people that I work around are some of the nicest. They if I get stuck on something or I can't figure something out, they help me. And I see so many people now in 60, even all 70, that are driving trucks, maybe not long haul, but they're driving short, and got let go of jobs and seem happier now than ever. That they're just. And the other thing is, these younger people I work for, they don't push me that hard. I told them I didn't want to be out more than 5 days, or this is what I can do, and they accommodate me. And a total different attitude from the way people pushed you 10, 20 years ago, you know.
Dave, thanks a lot for that story. That makes me think, I'm glad we heard Dave's story, but it also makes me think we hear of some industries, trucking one of them, where they're having a hard time filling seats, they're having a hard time hiring people. Are these older workers, as Dave says, an opportunity in industries like that?
Absolutely. School bus drivers, you see that a lot, that they're always hiring and looking for folks. And, you know, older folks want flexibility in their schedules. They want to work part-time. They don't want to be tied down to an 8-to-5. They want lower stressful jobs. You know, a lot of them have worked their entire careers in very, very high stress, high physically toiling jobs, and they're looking for something that is a little bit more fun, a little bit more relaxing, a little more flexible. So, you know, it's also great to hear Dave saying that the younger folks are willing to work with them and pitch in. That gets back to our earlier point of saying break down the walls, break down the myths by working directly with the generation gaps.
Dave, thanks for calling in. We'll go now to Deb in Milwaukee. Deb, hello.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What do you want to tell us about, Deb?
Well, I guess what I want to tell you is, what exactly is old? I'm in my 60s. I don't consider myself old. I mean, I've been listening to the show, and all I'm hearing is old. And I work with a lot of people in their 60s and 70s. And the problem I see is not maturity or tolerance or experience. The problem is totally on the mature people not accepting the cultural changes. People, maybe somebody in their 70s at work doesn't like tattoos. So they're offended by the tattoo or the facial piercing or the ear piercing. So I think if mature people really want to advance themselves in the workforce, they have to be tolerant.
Deb, thanks a lot for the call. Jim?
Absolutely. That is a wonderful point. And we always laugh all the time about, you know, who's considered old. You know, people will ask us at ARP, you know, what do you consider old? What do old people like to do? You know, we get that. We're like, well, the answer is people over 50 like to do the same things that people under 50 like to do. You know, you like to go out. You like to have fun. You like to engage in society. You like to go to your church and your schools and your community centers. Deb, that's an excellent point. Tolerance is a key, again, at any age. And that would be a function of ageism if someone is intolerant of someone old. But like you said, older people not being tolerant of younger people are not accepting or not accepting them for some of their idiosyncrasies or some of the things. That is just as relevant. You know, we've got to be tolerant of each other. As far as saying what is old, I am not going to give you an answer for that, because we purposely try not to use the word old because it doesn't really have a meaning.
Deb, thanks for the call. We're talking to Jim Flaherty from AARP Wisconsin, talking about people working later in life, more people in their 60s as a percentage, more in their 70s, more in their 80s. still in the workforce, going back to the workforce, taking your calls at 800-642-1234. Hannah is with us in Menominee. Hannah, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Hannah?
So I'm 22 years old, and I've worked in a couple crisis fields. I've worked at a women's shelter for domestic abuse and sexual assault, in a rehab facility, and right now I'm working with at-risk youth. And one thing I've really noticed, especially at the rehab facility and women's shelter, is a lot of my clients are much older than I am, and they're looking for people to fill those roles who are older to be counselors, because a lot of people, I feel like, have a hard time talking to people younger than them, like they don't understand maybe, or so the older people I've worked with have done really well with the clients.
Yeah, and a lot of that is, you know, the older folks have built up a lifetime of trust and experience, and they're a lot easier to talk to. Is it easier to talk to your grandfather or your father on a lot of issues? You know, it's there is tolerance among older folks because they have a base from which to draw experiences from, and they can be very helpful. I that is really refreshing to hear. I appreciate that call.
Thanks for the call, Hannah. We'll go now to Mark in Two Lakes. Mark, hi.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good. Did you have a question?
How do a computer illiterate person deal with society now?
All right, Mark, thanks. So for people who maybe weren't digital natives, Jim, didn't grow up with technology and want to get back in a field that uses some technology, how can they make that segue?
Yeah, that's a great question. Like I say, first of all, go to ARP.org and they have all kinds of sessions available to train you online. But if you don't know how to be online in the first place, that doesn't help you much. AARP Wisconsin does offer all kinds of training we have specifically in-classroom classes. They pop up in Milwaukee and down in like Racine, Kenosha area, and they help folks be familiar with their iPhones, help, you know, very basic, you know, here's how to job search in the digital age, here's how to set up your phone. And they will actually sit down in a classroom one-on-one setting and work with you. For that, I would keep checking back to our state website, which is arp.org/WI, and on the right-hand side, if you have access to a computer, you'll see some of the local job offerings that we've got right in southeastern Wisconsin.
And Mark, if you're looking, you might check your local senior center, community center, or library. They'll often have that kind of program as well. Jim, in our last couple of minutes, do you see workplaces getting better at avoiding age discrimination and bringing together generations at the workplace?
I absolutely do. I have a lot of confidence that we are going to adjust as society adjusts. Wisconsin's getting older. The nation's getting older. We know there's going to be more and more workers in the workplace. And I think that we are going to adjust. I have every confidence that employers are going to see the benefits long-term of saying, hey, maybe we would save a little money by getting rid of an experienced worker with a high salary and going with someone smaller. I get that. But I think more and more we're seeing them value experience over that. And so, you know, maybe it's an optimistic view, but I think it's what we're going to see going forward just because the workforce is getting older.
We'll leave it there. Jim, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
We've been talking to Jim Flaherty, Communications Director for AARP Wisconsin. He was with us in the studio to talk about an increase in older adults in the workforce. Thanks for all of your calls, and there's still time for you to share your experiences. If you are in the age range we're talking about, 60s, 70s, 80s, are you still working? Are you looking at working out into the future? And why? Is it financial necessity? Personal fulfillment, desire to get out there, an interest in helping others and sharing your skills. Again, tell us your story. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR or post over at the Ideas Network Facebook page. The Wisconsin State Fair is going on, and there's a lot of eating, and there's about to be a lot more. The fair is famous for the cream puffs and lots of deep-fried items, often on some form of stick. New foods this year include breakfast sausage in a waffle on a stick, deep-fried double-stuffed s'mores custard sundae, and French onion soup, wait, on a stick. These are all what Cookie Monster would call sometimes foods. But things will get real on Saturday with a competitive eating contest featuring some of the top-ranked eaters in the world, in this whole competitive eating circuit. What are they going to be eating? They're in Wisconsin. It's cheese curds. So I saw the press release on that. And of course, the first question is raw or fried cheese curds, because that's two completely different games. I did some digging online. It is raw cheese curds, which I could harder to chew, I think, but less calorie dense. Yeah, less of a gut bomb. So, but then it's raw. You've got the cheese curds. You've got the squeaking. So if you go to see this, I recommend some sort of ear protection because it's going to get loud with these pros. So the deal is they have 6 minutes to eat as many cheese curds as they can. I'll just say this once. Don't try this at home, kids. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.